Please put your hands together and wave them like you just don't care for the Reality Exploit Roundtable.
Good afternoon, or morning, or evening, wherever you are. I'm Plato from Pound Agora, and this is Reality Exploit Roundtable, Episode 8. Our panelists today, so far, we've got Smuggler and Voodoo. How's it going, guys?
Hey, man.
Going great.
Fantastic. Hero should be joining us soon, although he is lost on some mysterious mission. Wise Guy sadly cannot be with us today. Last I know, he was negotiating with Donald Trump to buy the state of Montana. So let's start with our first topic, covering the latest in surveillance: microchipping the kids. Kansas news station KSN reports that two schools in San Antonio, Texas, are mandating RFID badges to track their students. And of course, as usual, they say it's for their kids' own safety. Let's listen to a clip.
Andrea Hernandez says she and other teens are going to be rebels. Starting tomorrow, about 4,000 students at John Jay High School and Anson Jones Middle School must wear a new and controversial photo ID called the Radio Frequency Identification System. It tracks students while they're on campus. Some call it a spy chip. Andrea says many students just won't wear it. According to NISD, the new microchip ID is for student safety and to check attendance. We're told both John Jay and Anson Middle School have poor attendance records. And if those records improve, the district could gain about $2 million in state funding.
It comes down to money. It's not about the safety and security of students, ultimately.
You know, when the smartphone's in, you can use the option to use your locator, but this, I can't turn it off.
Ouch. Sorry for you kids. Now, Voodoo, if we didn't forcibly indoctrinate our children in a Prussian-style public school system that's designed to produce, you know, compliance and obedience to authority, then they wouldn't respect authority and they wouldn't be compliant. I mean, I was homeschooled, and look at me, now I'm an anarchist. Treating kids like cattle, that's the obvious move for the control freaks who are in charge of education. So, what should these kids do to beat the system?
Actually, I wouldn't even go for beating the system if I was these kids. I'd go for really messing with it. The whole point of the RFID was to be able to track things that move. And what we figured out, or what the controllers have figured out, is that, hey, not only can you track things that move, but they're really good at tracking the things that move them, or people. We've got RFIDs in passports and credit cards and your wallet and all over. So... The controllers, they really want to track where people are moving. And in this case, they want to track when these kids come in the door or come onto the campus of the school, so that they get credit for them at the end of the day, or get credit for them being there that day, and they don't have to take attendance in homeroom. They don't have to worry about the kids being in the hallway or talking with some other teacher or something and not getting counted for that day, so they get the money for them. But if I was these kids, I would really mess with it, because anytime you've got some sort of tracking system, you've got a database associated with it, they could do all sorts of hacks. Take one student's, because these are unencrypted RFIDs, by the way, so you could take one student's RFID, clone that one, and so that one day every kid that walks in the door would have the same RFID code that gets scanned, so they would get, the school would get credit for one student being there that day. Or, you know, they could do all sorts of hacks to mess with these. I would use it as an opportunity to hack it. And you know what, the hacker culture, especially young among teens, is really strong. I know there's the whole meme that being smart is uncool, but hacking is something where kids really get it, and they're good at hacking stuff, and if done right, the geeks could really mess with the school on this one.
That would be pretty fun. You mentioned that it's just the teachers being lazy, and that puts me in mind of there's a teacher strike going on in Chicago, U.S., and I think these guys are getting $80,000 a year or something, and yet their fifth grade students still can't read. So I don't know. They're obviously not doing a very good job, and they just want more time to, you know, drink their coffee and play on their iPods instead of, you know, giving these children useful life skills.
Well, and what's really interesting is that they went on strike, but they were offered a 16% salary increase over the next 4 years. They rejected that, though, because Rahm Emanuel, of all people, wanted to tie salaries to student performance on standardized tests. And the unions just do not want that. They do not want teachers to be judged on performance at all. They want teachers to be judged on whether they were there or not and their qualifications to hold the job.
So essentially, we can replace a teacher with an RFID chip.
Yeah, it sounds that way. If you just put all the kids in a classroom without a teacher and gave them Wikipedia, they would probably end up doing a bit better in life than if they have a teacher there who's just spouting out the party line, whatever their union is telling them to teach.
If the students just could read. But coming back to the RFID for a second here, I think that what Voodoo said about hacking the system, exploiting it, I mean, that's really the thing. There's so much fun in doing that. I mean, just think about it, having a cloned ID that you give to your friend goes to school, and you stay at home, or having your ID pop up randomly on the schoolyard with improbable speed, or whatever. I mean, there's so many things you can do. It's incredibly. And the only problem is, I think that teachers should first trust the system to be really good, because then maybe you can send in the best student to the best class with your ID and you get the mark.
There you go. And that student just has to carry 20 IDs in his back pocket. And hopefully the teacher's dumb
Awesome.
enough that he doesn't even notice that there's only one kid in class. In the US, actually, it turns out that the only group who tests worse on standardized tests than school teachers is school administrators.
I can absolutely believe that. The school administrators are they're bureaucrats. So, but that's where the majority of these high salaries are sitting in the bureaucrat jobs, the administrators. If you get rid of a lot of that, then you probably could bump up teacher salaries without having to hit all the taxpayers that hard, including taxpayers like, oh, I don't know, me, that don't have kids, don't want anything to do with kids.
It blows my mind how poorly run and how inefficient the US school system is. We spend over $10,000 per year per student from kindergarten through grade 12. That's 13 years. I mean, $10,000 a year, that's enough for like a really nice microscope and a telescope and a bunch of computers. And it's totally feasible to move everything to a distributed online education system, something, Wolfram Alpha is a great start. The Khan Academy is a great start. Marginal Revolution, economics blog, they're launching a economics university online with free courses. And this kind of distributed education, you can get the marginal costs really, really low because you can have, thousands of students who are all cooperating together. Instead of having to pay 100 teachers for 1,000 students, you're paying, 10 teachers, and the students are helping each other out.
Yeah, but you assume already that the schools are there for teaching students something they can use in life, like real knowledge about stuff. I think that's a misconception. I think the reason we have schools is first and foremost to keep kids from the streets and keep kids from learning on their own, to make them docile slaves. That's the purpose of schools, and they're very efficient in doing that.
Yes, I agree, but I don't think that's, the popular conception. People across the world believe that school is necessary to get a good education so you can get a good job so you can get a lot of money. And I guess that's true to some small extent because, companies won't hire you if you don't have a high school diploma. But the function of education should not be indoctrination, although I agree that currently that is the function of education.
But I'm not so certain that people don't agree with the indoctrination either, or believe that their children are getting an education. You know, a big portion of the mandatory schooling laws is to keep the kids out of the workforce. You know, everybody rails against child labor. Everybody just is absolutely incensed that a child might grow up at an age where they are a mature human being, that they would have a mental age that would allow them to function in society. The way the world works, at least in the Western world these days, is a 12-year-old to 16-year-old, that's considered infant, maybe, you know, toddler. And maybe by the time you're 23, 25, you are considered a young adult.
Yeah, that whole concept of adolescence, that as far as I know, that was developed by the masters of propaganda, Bernays, and the guys who built the U.S. school system, as you say, to keep people out of the workforce and help make sure that they're getting, you know, the proper amount of brainwashing.
Yep, and you guys hit on it. You know, if you put the kids in with a microscope and telescope and Wikipedia or whatever, you know, that's the unschooling concept. Is the child or the young adult directs their own learning, whatever interests them. And heck, you know what? Depending on how the child directs it, instead of actually costing for that child's education, the child might actually make money during their education and be able to pay for it and be a productive member of society at a very young age.
But then it will also learn to pay taxes that early. And I tell you, forcing a 16-year-old to pay taxes on his hard-earned school money, that's kind of hard. You know, it could break the state.
I remember distinctly when I was 12 years old and got my first paycheck, and I was getting, I don't even remember how much per hour, but I'd already worked out in my head, I've worked this many hours and I've gotten getting this much per hour. Hey, wait a second. How come a big chunk of my paycheck's missing?
I'm sorry to hear it, Voodoo.
Yeah, well, at 12 years old, I was basically a child slave.
And then you learned how to do underground business?
No, not at all. That's just a myth. Nobody does that. We're all totally law-abiding taxpayers. All right, one final thought on this is that for these students in San Antonio, if any of you happen to be listening, you should know that it's trivial to block an RFID signal. If you put a conductor in between the reader and the chip, it interferes with the EM radiation and prevents the reader from reading the chip. So in our show notes, you can find instructions on Wired for building a wallet out of duct tape and tinfoil that blocks RFID signals. Or all you really need to do is take a sheet of tinfoil, fold it up around your card, and put your card in your wallet. And that should be good enough to stop those signals from getting through. Although I do really like Voodoo's idea of screwing with the system, and I think that's a lot more entertaining. So Google Hackerspaces in San Antonio, find your local hackerspace, see if they have an RFID reader, and start cloning some IDs. All right, let's move on to our second topic, which is hacking the human brain. Yusarian from Poundagora has more.
Hey, Plato. Wired reports, quote, a team of security researchers from Oxford, UC Berkeley and the University of Geneva say that they were able to deduce digits of PIN numbers, birth month, areas of residence and other personal information by presenting 30 headset-wearing subjects with images of ATM machines, debit cards, maps, people and random numbers in a series of experiments. For the study, the researchers used the Emotive Epoch Neuro headset, which retails for $299. End quote. The researchers flashed brief images of debit cards, PIN numbers and faces, and watched the output of the EEG headset for P300 peaks. Those are spikes in neural activity that occur when the brain recognizes a stimulus. With this information, the researchers were able to guess the secrets about 20% more reliably than randomly guessing. Back to Plato in the RER bunker.
Thanks, Isarian. So this attack has some scary implications, at least in my head. You might think that you're just controlling your World of Warcraft character with your mind, but actually, that malware you downloaded from your porn site is in your brains, guessing your passwords. So, Smuggler, the CIA, if they're in this situation, they take the brute force approach. They use MKUltra techniques to just wipe out the minds of anyone who has sensitive info. So, for us peaceful folk, how do we defend against attacks on our minds?
Well, that really depends on the attack, right? As for the example of you thinking that you control your whatever battleship with your mind right now, you're actually not open to that attack. The attack is really based on the so-called P300 signal, which is a spike in your brainwave activity that happens about 300 milliseconds after you recognize something that is connected to the task you have your mind on, and that something is of low probability to be expected. So it's really not something that happens without you noticing. You know that your mind is hacked unless you're social engineered into taking part in, you know, something you don't understand that reveals the data. But the good guess is this. If you are made to think about something secret, like your bank account number or your ATM card PIN code, if someone asks you to think about that, then you're in trouble already. Just don't think about it. Don't comply. The rule number one to escape from being heard out, from being revealing secrets, is don't cooperate with whoever wants the secret. Don't play with them, don't get along. Just shut up and think about something very, very different.
Okay, I didn't realize that you had to be actively thinking about the stimulus in question that they're trying to get in order for this attack to work. So if I'm thinking about muffins and somebody flashes an image of my debit card, that P300 wave won't show up?
Yeah, exactly. It depends a little bit on how you think about muffins. You have to have a special, you know, it's not enough to visualize a muffin. And you have to keep your mind primed with thinking about something muffin-like. Memorizing a receipt or something like that. And then your mind would actually be on a task that is unrelated to whatever secret people want from you. There will still be a signal, but the signal from the ATM card flashed at you will be more or less the same, no matter what kind of card is flashed to you.
All right, that's good to hear. You know, I've met a few folks who are really into training their minds and trying to make sure that they're focused and driven and not wasting their thoughts, but letting them drift and talk about other stuff. And for the most part, you know, my response and the internet response is, oh, these guys are, you know, it's cool. They're getting in a Zen state where they're able to control their thoughts, but what actual benefit is that? And maybe if we do see further progress into this brain hacking and EEG headsets, maybe those guys are actually onto something and there might be actual tangible benefits to having a strongly organized mind, as opposed to, you know, somebody who sits in front of their TV and they're accustomed to seeing, you know, 30 seconds or, you know, it's 3 seconds of a shot at a time, and then they need to move on to another stimulus and get something else to fire some more neurons to keep them entertained.
Actually, I think that even without brain hacking, there's a good reason why you should train your brain, and especially training your focus and stuff like that. I mean, there are so many situations in life where that comes handy. If it's, you know, driving the car in a dangerous situation, if your brain is used to be focused, you will actually have an upper hand in an accident when it comes to reacting to the danger, when it comes to getting your job done, and so on and so on. There are good things to do. And if you're interested in something like that, there's a good program that's actually a little bit fun. It's called Brain Workshop. It's open source and free software, and you can train your focus levels, your memory levels, and so on with it. And it's actually a pretty good thing to get your mind working, and actually maybe even higher your IQ. And as we all know, IQ is the new cool.
Nice. I actually had a book when I was a kid. It was by Harry Lorraine, and I can't remember the title, but it was Secrets of Mind Power. And he had a bunch of different techniques that you could use to improve your memory, for one. And I never was very good at it because I didn't really practice enough. But if you go online and you search for train your memory, you'll find a bunch of techniques and a bunch of resources that you can use to organize your thought processes so you can remember faces and names and lists of stuff without having to write them down. And I can definitely see how that skill would be powerful.
Right, but I think that people actually should not go just into mnemonics, that is remembering stuff, but really go into focus training. It has helped me a lot to be able to really move myself forcibly into focus on a task, and actually go so far as to induce a flow state with a very, very high success rate. And the cool thing is, if you're a brain worker, like a programmer or something like that, if you're used to work under high focus, and you do it and do it and do it again, sooner or later you will enter flow. And with flow, work is no work anymore. It's just a joy.
And there are physical analogs to that too, not just mental work, but on physical work. Basketball players, a lot of coaches have basketball players. When you lay down to sleep at night, visualize yourself shooting 50 free throws. If you can visualize it in your head, that actually goes toward training. I shouldn't say training your muscles, but helping you coordinate your muscles to shoot free throws. Same way with golf shots. And of course, that would transfer over to anything that you were trying to do physically.
Well, I guess I have some practice ahead of me.
You might win your next kickball game if you visualize yourself kicking the ball 50 times before you go to sleep. The other thing, even just mentally though, just really something that has helped me over the last, I don't know, 30 years, is I don't have any trouble sleeping ever. I can lay down and go to sleep within 30 seconds, a minute, just from doing a technique where it's basically a meditation, where I pick something to focus on and it just puts me right to sleep.
I actually started doing a very similar thing. I read a book called Mind Games, and I can't remember the authors, but they illustrate a technique to put your mind into they term it an altered state of consciousness, but it's basically self-hypnosis. So what I do when I'm falling asleep, I imagine I'm looking at a computer terminal and I type in Plato and I press enter, and out comes the output trance. And I do that, 50 times until I can feel myself just slipping into, a state of a trance. And at that point, the output changes from trance to deeper. And I do that another 50 times and I'm asleep, because I'm focusing on this one thing and all the external stimuli are just, bouncing off my subconscious, and I'm not really bothering to listen to those. And that's all you need to get to sleep.
And that exactly would be a pretty good method to beat that neuroscanner that wants your PIN number.
Fantastic.
Absolutely. One thing back on the researchers here that did this, one of the group of researchers was from UC Berkeley. Berkeley does some neat things, but some things are kind of hokey coming out of Berkeley, brain research also. They came out with something about 2 years ago that was said that they could figure out the actual value that somebody placed on a public good or service by looking at brain in a MRI. And so your brain would light up, so you could say, well, I'm willing to pay up to $30,000 a year for defense and police, but then they could tell your actual valuation in this MRI, which was complete hokum because there would be no way to compare from one person to another, you know, what their valuation was. And so things like that, you have to be kind of careful of some of the research coming out of Berkeley. They do so much research that some of it ends up being hokum that unfortunately newspapers pick up on right away and report as fact.
All right, I'll keep that in mind. Let's move on to an earlier interview I did today with Nicole from the streets of Goldman, USA. Well, it appears that we have some small-scale looting going on. I see one flipped cop car, and you might be able to hear some gunfire in the distance. We've got Nicole from Australia here to tell us the motivation behind this wanton destruction. Nicole?
The citizenry is up in arms, all right. The most common motive I hear has to do with broken promises from the leaders. Apparently Obonny promised every American a free taco last month if they voted him into office. Since then, taco production has been maxed out, but mysteriously, a full three-quarters of the tacos have been eaten by 1% of the population. The other 99% are understandably upset, and apparently they feel it's gone far enough. The police response isn't helping matters either. My sister purchased some ground beef from a farmer to make her own tacos but was thrown in jail for violating USDA regulations on beef transactions.
Wow, Nicole, that's brutal. My condolences are with your sister. What do you propose we do to fix this?
While we have a surplus of pigs, the solution is obvious to me. We got to grind those
Aw, shucks, sounds like our feed dropped out. Well, thank you so much, Nicole. Let's head back to the RER studio. Matt, I'm sorry to hear about this senseless violence, and I hope it abates. Let's move on again, and hopefully we won't see these taco riots in the upcoming privately run cities that are being constructed in Honduras. So the Honduran government just gave the okay for three privately run cities, and these are the brainchild of a guy named Paul Romer. He's a NYU economist, and he believes that importing sound laws and policies into small corners of badly run countries will help leaders reform their governments from the inside out. So this guy runs a website, chartercities.org, and he was part of a five-man transparency committee, and it was charged by the Honduran government with building the governments of upcoming charter cities. And there was some political bullshit, and there's constitutional challenges of whether this is even legal, so the Transparency Committee just recently published an open letter relinquishing their entire role in the project. So instead, the Honduran government has signed a deal with the MKG Group, and that's a consortium of investors who are led by Michael Strong, and they intend to spend $15 million to start building basic infrastructure on a city near Trujillo on the Caribbean coast. So Strong, he's a libertarian, and he's on the board of the directors of the Seasteading Group. He says that, in general, free zones have been a spectacular success in terms of economic development. I'm very optimistic. Let's listen to some clips from Michael Strong's 2011 TED Talk at TEDUXFM.
When it gets down to it, I think it's much harder to really think for ourselves than we realize. And we're far more deeply biologically programmed to submit to authorities, whether it's society as a whole or authorities in our lives, be it bosses or parents or churches or university professors or the media or whatever. I think that it's far more of a struggle to come to our own understanding of who we are and what our role is in the world and what we believe is authentically true, good, and beautiful than most of us realize. And, you know, but it was one of those interesting experiments, and every once in a while, just try to do what you think is right for you, no matter what's happening in the world at large. And as you become conscious of when you are submitting to outside authority versus when you're pushing out against it, you will gradually become ever more refined at learning what levels society is pushing on you, and it's not really authentically you. I would say that the ultimate disruptive technology is you. Every time you are an authentic, honest expression of your own belief in the true, the good, and the beautiful on whatever issue, no matter how trivial, no matter how profound, that if you come into the world as an honest person and tell us what you believe, not what the authorities have told you, not what society tells you, but what your inner genius tells you, this is what is real about the world, then you are the disruptive technology that will change the world. And as cool as iPads are, you are even cooler than iPads. Thank you.
Man, this guy sounds awesome. He sounds like an anti-authoritarian who wants to make society more profitable and hopefully more just in the process. So these private cities, this is really going to be the first real-life test of a society, you know, a large-scale society, a whole city, that's operating outside the umbrella of traditional states. So, Hero, welcome back to the show. And wondering if you can tell us, does Strong actually have a chance to compete against all the crazy dictators with nukes who currently rule the world?
I don't know that they can have a chance of competing against large nation states individually, but with lots of small distributed technologies, sometimes the scale of them and networked together can make a difference. The interesting thing I think here is that some of the people are watching this and are thinking, okay, well, I'm an anarchist and I'm interested in a city like this. But you really need to look back and see that a lot of these charter type cities, they are not just an anarchist free-for-all where someone has declared in this zone there is no government. In many cases, it's actually much completely the opposite. Many of these places are actually private dictatorships. Now, I'm not criticizing that. I'm saying it's just like you are in your home. You are private in a place where you have private property and you control the locks and the doors to your house and who comes in, and when they need to leave and you don't want somebody there, you tell them they can't come in. You essentially are a dictator over your own private property, what happens there. So what the larger issues here with this are, who's going to be running these cities? Are these going to be run by the group of people? Are these going to be like small corporate cities? Are they going to be a democratic free-for-all once again? So I find some problems with the Paul Romer stuff in the beginning, where he talks about how you can possibly importing good laws into poorly run or corrupt countries. The situation, I think, is this item that I keep bringing up on every show. Everybody's hears it from me all the time, is decentralization. And that is, if we had a one world government and everyone says, well, you know, the United Nations is thinking about decentralizing into individual nation states. And that may not be the actual, you know, ideal thing that everyone would want, but it's a good step. And then if all the individual states themselves, like the United States, if it broke up into 50 states or Europe, you know, you decentralize, all of a sudden you start having these individual competing jurisdictions. So what I find fascinating with these cities in Honduras is this point right here. If this is just one city that's popping up, and then there's another one that's supposedly getting ready to sign a deal in Honduras. So now we're talking two cities down there that may have their own laws, their own police, their own the whole, you know, the whole shebang. It actually is going to be like a small mini government, but run in a different way. And they're going, if you want to be join up one of these, you're going to need to agree to their particular rules and whatever their price is for staying there and the like. But the thing is that you're going to have the freedom to leave, and you maybe choose another city. So this could turn into something that is that could spread throughout the globe, and especially with the current economic situation. Why would Honduras do this? Why would a lot of countries around the world start allowing people to have charter cities? So as the economy starts to fall more, there's going to be more people who are more interested in making more deals for money. That's why the Honduras government is doing this right now. I'm not going to go as far to say that this is absolute an example of corruption, but it's pretty close to it, because these guys are creating a city and they're getting a ton of money for it. So there's all kinds of deals going on here, and that can be a good thing. So I don't know, I just could see, I have a vision in the future that as economies start to fall, you start seeing these similar type of burbclave type cities possibly popping up all over the third world and the second world and the first world. And then you're talking about actually giving, maybe not competing with any particular nation state, but you might start competing with the nation, the idea of a nation state. itself.
The devil's in the details here. The AP story made it sound like that these places are going to be making their own laws. It's not true. It's completely the opposite. The president of Honduras is going to appoint a board of, quote, internationally well-known business types who do not have a financial interest in these cities, and they're making all the rules. That sounds like scary to me. I agree with your point, Hero, that competition's great. You know, at least it's something different. But I don't foresee this being any sort of libertarian utopia, certainly not anything that that's it's going to be more of a company city than anything.
Yeah, under a nation-state jurisdiction. See, that's where the type of charter cities I'm talking about are the ones where you're talking about a government giving a sovereign charter, similar to the Hong Kong thing in the past, and they were trying to do this in Costa Rica and a couple other places, where the government really was going to give a hands-off type, literally leasing a part of their country and removing themselves from that jurisdiction. If that's not happening here, then I don't think it's almost a yawn situation.
It's hard to tell. From the articles that I've read, it's unclear whether this is actually going to be sovereign. However, fastcoexist.com does report that the city will have their own hospitals, schools, judges, and police forces independent of Honduran law. So outside of those jurisdictions, it's possible that perhaps they are subject to Honduran law. But again, it's also possible they're not. So I guess we'll have to look into it a bit further.
Smuggler?
Well, it's hard to make a real judgment on it. Even if it's a corporate city, it's another place you can't be. I mean, I'm not really opposed to benevolent dictators and everything like that. So if it's a little bit different and people can choose to go there and choose to leave, then I'm all for it. And the more we have of that, the better it is.
Yeah, that's a great point. The more options that people have, the more chances that they have to vote with their dollars and move to communities that do offer, you know, justice and the opportunity to live a good life.
What I really find interesting with the whole subject is response in media, and not just in Honduras or the US, but even over here in Europe, where you have these typical statist reflexes breaking through, where they say, no, we cannot let that happen because it's capitalist, or it's not with the state, or it's a state in the state, or it takes away control, and so on and so on. You have so many people here, articles even that are written, that simply criticize the whole idea. Not because of the specifics, but just because it adds a new layer to the field.
Well, I will hope and pray that Michael Strong manages to make a libertarian paradise, but we'll reserve judgment until we see it.
One thing I was thinking of, or have been thinking about since this came back around, because remember this was a story about a year ago where Patrick Friedman was actually involved with this, trying to get Honduras to do this, and then and I guess Michael Strong is a partner with Patrick Friedman in seasteading. But one thing I've been thinking is, what are the because they're going to start with a half square mile here, developing it for $15 million. What are the things that would be essential to make a free port like this? And looking at the map, it's going to be in an excellent location. What are the essential things that a free port like this would need that we could actually start building right away? In terms of anything, what infrastructure is going to need to be built out here?
Well, I'd love to see them put in a mesh net, point-to-point communications instead of our traditional IP backbones. And again, as Hiro's saying, that offers some decentralization And that's a giant advantage, especially in a small economy with a lot of participants. If you can remove the friction of having to pay, you know, one ISP for the use of their pipes, it's economically a sound decision.
I know go ahead, Smuggler.
I'm sorry, Hero, but I just have to say that you, of course, need tube mail.
Totally. We got to put in a pneumatic tube system in order to, move around the, substances.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say, Smuggler, was the tube mail thing. And I was thinking about this the other day, that it would be a great proposal to throw towards some of the guys that are doing this right off the bat. A tube mail system.
And actually, it's less a joke than it sounds. I mean, please, tube mail is like packet switch networking for physical packets. You know, I mean, this is revolutionary, and we had it like 2 years ago. But coming back to the question of what do we need and mesh networks, I do actually think that mesh network is too much of a decision already. When you say, let's put that in, because mesh networks aren't that ideal in many situations. I think that one of the big things how you can start a good city is by having a good underground pipe system where you can rent out space without digging up the soil every time you want to put a gable in there. And there's enough space that you can use down there. So I think that is where you really have to look at and focus on to be flexible enough for the future.
Are you talking about people's basements, so you could rent out basement space, or are you talking about like interconnects, like the tubes?
I'm talking about tunnels, like second or third level below the street level, that you would use to put cables in for whatever power supply, for telecommunication, for tube mail, but where you are just one level above the water and sewer system, and where you have enough space that it's realistic for hundreds of independent ISPs to run their fibers, or for hundreds of different power companies providing power, stuff like that. And the big problem we have in many cities today is that it's very, very hard to access underground spaces for infrastructure networks. You have to dig it up, or it's very, very limited down there, so you don't have much you can put in there. So, for example, where I come from, we're using the subway system now to run fiber cables to have our own ISPs. If you run them through the subway system.
Well, that is an absolutely fantastic thing that you just brought up there, Smuggler, because that is one of the things that causes specific government monopolies or unnatural market domination, is this problem with the cables above. And if you set that up down below, then you have distribution system expansion that's able for all the different forms of, electric, water, and then, like you said, the tube mail and the internet and all that. What kind of prices are they renting these things out for, and how big would be the tubes that you're suggesting to put in the ground? Not for the tube mail, but are you talking that these people should consider like subway type underground tunnels?
Yeah, or a little bit smaller, actually, because you don't have to carry people through it. You just have to have enough space to run several hundred cables there. And then many of those monopolies we have, like our power and telecommunication, simply breaks down because there's a low-cost access to build a new network, and then competition goes up and so on and so on. And then you don't need mesh networks anymore. Then you have so many independent ISPs that you have the same benefit without the same drawbacks.
You would need a property rights system where the competition has equal access to the tunnels. Because if I have a house and there's a tunnel running underneath it, and the property rights system grants me dominion over the tunnel, then I can tell people that they can't use it. So maybe I have a personal grudge against somebody and I can block them out of the network. And that's not going to fly. So you'll need to make sure that, you know, whatever system is governing property rights is letting everybody use these tunnels.
Exactly.
You'd have property rights in the tunnel if you build it, Plato, but if you just own the land that's on top, on the surface there, you wouldn't have anything to do with the tunnel. You don't get the entire column if you homestead a footprint on the surface like that.
Sure, and the tunnels would most likely be built by Michael Strong and company, the groups doing the contracting. So this corporate city, the corporation that is in charge of the entire area, they would be the ones who own the tunnels, most likely.
Right, and the interesting thing is you could do something like a combination of 3D property rights, both above ground and below ground and in the tunnels, and combine that with something that is a property or a title ledger. And we have something like that, and it's Bitcoin. Essentially, you can use the Bitcoin technology to have a title management system for a new city that doesn't require a bureaucracy anymore. It only requires a few servers, and whoever develops the city in the first place has to create those titles and put them into the system. And that you would do for the tunnels, you would do for underground, you would do for above ground, three-dimensional space, and then every kind of combination on property would be possible. And all you need to do it is you need a computer. And the great thing is then no title you have can just be stolen from you. You have a very secure system. You have a system that is very, very cheap to run, and that's easy to enforce. So that is something I would strongly suggest to those people to do.
Yep. I love it.
Amazing.
Fantastic. Yeah, we can take the entire functionality of the DMV and put it in a computer program, so you don't have to deal with all this bureaucratic bullshit and inefficiency. You just fire up your client and say, "I'm looking to sell a title to this property. If somebody wants to make a trade, then you sign off the transaction. It goes in a blockchain, and the entire public now knows that this new guy holds title to that property."
Right, and you could even support something like Strong Property System or just a possession system, because there are people that say, okay, we just want possession, we don't want dormant systems and dormant landlords. So you could do something like Namecoin, you know, where your title actually expires.
Yeah, and then you can actually execute smart contracts on the title, so that you could lease or actually mortgage the titles that you own.
Right, and I propose that we panelists of Reality Exploit Roundtable take over those cities and tell them how to do it.
Well,
deal.
The reason I asked the question about the infrastructure is to hear you guys' idea. I heard two solid business plans right there that don't require anything to do with Michael Strong or the government of Honduras. Both the mesh network and registering titles with the through the Namecoin or the Bitcoin system. Either one of those we could do right now. And as a business venture, and we don't have to have the permission of either Michael Strong or the Honduran government.
Unless somebody comes after us with guns and says, hey, give us all the property.
Which is in a Bitcoin blockchain.
Yeah, they can come with guns all they want, and we go, okay, whatever. But it's persisted in the blockchain.
Well, I guess you've beaten my objections out of me.
But, you know, as far as I love the tunnel idea, and, you know, again, but I think that's something that Strong and company are going to have to do, or you're going to have to work with them to be able to do. But the mesh network you could set up right now. You know the area that they're going to be building this, the first section of this city. You could grid it right now with a mesh network on poles and have them be solar powered.
Or better, even on a balloon then you don't need that many and you cover a larger area and it's further away from whoever wants to cut down the stuff.
Yeah, that works, but this is an area that does get hurricanes now and then.
Damn.
Fantastic.
Well, one last point I'd like to throw in here, too, is that I think that at the beginning you were asking whether these systems can compete. I think that it's sort of the way I see a lot of this stuff is that it's not so much if these ideas will be able to take over the world in a sense of like a large corporation or a large government dominating. I think that many of these ideas are going to be necessities. So over the coming years, we're going to start seeing more of these cities, these type charter type cities or seasteading type places or these other TAS type environments are going to become more of, there's more of a need for them. Therefore, they will rise up in spite of what type of effect they're and contrary to what they are to other places, just because there's such of a need for this type of a thing. So I see these things more bubbling up and taking place as a natural progression in light of all the other things happening in the world and in the large systems failing.
Fantastic, guys. Excellent thoughts. I think we're probably going to have to get in touch with Michael Strong and tell him about these tunnels and see if we can't change the world just a little bit more.
Or how about get in touch with the indigenous people whose land this is actually being taken from and have them do it themselves if they think it's a good idea.
Yeah, we could go down there and do the 3D grid map out property title thing and give the indigenous people their Bitcoin property titles and have them work that out with these new guys.
That would be cool, actually.
Sure makes it a lot less like putting the indigenous people on reservations to me.
Well, let's hope and pray that we can manage to build a just society with these new tools. Any final thoughts on distributed cities?
I want my own.
How about we share it?
No.
I think that one of the problems with these distributed cities, these type of things, is that you're creating a city in which the right to have the city and to operate it in the way that it is actually being granted.
Right.
And then they're coming in and then they're building an infrastructure. And I hope this works out and I hope this idea spreads and I have good all these great things for all this. But it's not as interesting to me as the cities that are going to be able to be dynamically grown and almost spontaneously appearing based upon particular types of engineering decisions and groupings together and technological things like the stuff that we brought up today. These type of things, I find them much more interesting because they can happen on a more of they have more of a potential of growing on a global scale, like I was saying earlier, in little pockets all over the place, like the 3D printing in your home. It's different when the government says, we're going to grant this particular area of manufacturing, one square mile of manufacturers in this area are going to be able to use this type of technology for 3D printing, and they're going to be able to do this, and they're going to be able to do this, and they're going to be able to do that, as opposed to tens of thousands of people all around the world just spontaneously starting to do these things on their own. So that's why I have kind of mixed feelings on both of these as far as my excitement goes.
Hero, I agree.
That's a fair point. It's not the end game because it is still operating within the paradigm of states granting the corporation rights to build a city. But it's a good start, and I do certainly hope that we move on to, you know, true grounds up, just people starting their own cities and just giving a big middle finger to the states who claim the rights over the land. Hey listeners, this is Plato chiming in with a brief errata. Shortly after we recorded RER Episode 8, Michael Strong appeared on Free Talk Live and covered a couple things that we just touched on. First off, the MGK group is not going to be building their first city at Trujillo, and they're not taking land from the indigenous Garifuna people. They're going to be purchasing land from private landowners in one of the other two sites. Second off, they assure businesses that they'll be able to operate under their own contract law, and they are not going to be forced into a legal system. They're going to be segregating the criminal and civil laws. Third, you can visit the project's website at grupomgk.com. And finally, if you want to listen to the entire Michael Strong interview, which I strongly suggest, he talks about security and a bunch of interesting stuff, that's in the September 10th, 2012 edition of Free Talk Live. Thanks. Back to the episode. That's all we got time for Reality Exploit Roundtable, Episode 8. I'm Plato. You can find me on Twitter, GitHub, and Reddit as The Real Plato. Smuggler operates Anarplex.net, and you can sign up for his mysterious new project, Shadowlife.cc. And Voodoo operates Black and Yellow Pages. And Hero, of course, AgorasRadio.com, who hosts all our shows, at AgorasRadio.bit. We got one final thing for you today, and that is Rap News 15, covering the surveillance state. Roll it.
Welcome back, netizens, to this newest edition in Juice Media series of rap news journalism with me, Robert Foster. This evening, we're actively delving in depth to facts which affect all of us who dwell on this internet. And we've got to give a special welcome to all the ladies and agents from the NSA, ACO, MI5. Glad you're listening in, because today's show is all about surveillance and how it's spreading from the streets into our modems. As we speak, laws are being tacitly written in to implement ways of controlling the expanse of this internet. To keep us safe, we're told. But from whom? And will this place ever be the same if these plans go through? To find out, we connect with our first guest to comment on the matter. We're live at the Panopticon with General Baxter. General?
Son.
Good to have you back again with us. Explain why the state is spying on us.
My fellow Oceanians, as you know, we've always been at war with Eurasia.
Or is it East Asia?
Either way, it's war and we need division to wage it. But now the proles are connecting online, bypassing these illusory divisions of race, religion, and nationality.
Sounds grand to me.
It's a catastrophe. Centuries of hard work are being undone, profits are vanishing, and it's due to the internet. It's empowering humanity. We need to get this snafu under control rapidly.
How?
Behold the latest weapon in the war of terror. Our greatest invention since 9/11. Guaranteed to keep us free and safe forever. I give you the surveillance state, ladies and generals. Our secret wires log your key style. Monitor every single number on your speed dial. Rewind straight to your position with facial recognition and pinpoint you within 0.03 of a mile. We've put eyes everywhere without consulting you, keeping you safe whether or not you want us to. Soon there'll be no freedoms left for threatening. Then we'll have won the war. Take that, terrorism.
Brilliant. Thank you, General. We now interview our resident guru, Terrence Moonseed, for a different view.
Greetings.
How does this situation look?
I have one word for you, Robert. Double plus on good. The world populace of 7.4 billion are all headed in the direction of Orwellian totalitarian oblivion. My voice is hoarse, yelling about stellar winds, cold chilling them, and trap wire weaving through the world wide web we all dwelling in. Face it, the all-seeing eyes in all of our Facebooks like a virus, and in these iPhones with Siri, or should I say Iris. Next in line is RFID devices and mind chips triggered by chemtrails the plague spray the sky. I win. This time it's too far. Check out the base they're building in Utah, where they'll be storing all your data for over a century. It's FUBAR. And under the outback is an entire tunnel of wires, an echelon base called Pine Gap to hijack our mother Gaia.
Hey, maybe your mother's gayer.
Boo-hoo. Why didn't you just kill yourself like most of your troops do?
That's it. Now you're on the cast iron list.
Hang on, General. Why weren't we informed about this?
Sorry we didn't tell you about our grand plan before. It was meant to be a surprise, under wraps in a store. But some spoil sports had to go and ruin it for all by blowing whistles in spite of the damn law.
Bill, Benny, and Thomas Drake are trailblazers for leaking these tactics.
Hey, civil liberty activists, activists, this is all legal. Anything we do now actually is.
How did
you can't question my authority, thanks to this.
And that shit's global, people. In Australia, it's now legal for the government to store all SMS's, searches, and emails. Australia
aliens is taking place under your nose. Unless you wake up, all your data are belong to ASIO.
Come on, everyone knows you can trust the government now. If you got nothing to hide, you got nothing to worry about.
That might be the case with things that are happening now, because most people agree with most of the laws that are being handed down. But once the Illuminati reveal their agenda for you, this surveillance will enforce laws you no longer consent to. But by then it'll be too late to protest too, and anything you've ever said, typed or browsed can or will be used against you.
I'm confused. So what should we do then?
What should we do?
Nothing.
This is all an illusion. It's just a ride, a delusion. The Matrix, the Maya deceiving us.
Oh, you hippies really make our job so much easier.
Sorry to interrupt, but we're picking up a signal from beyond the space-time continuum. Quick, switch on the juice channeling portal. Wait, is that George Orwell?
Good day to you.
Wow, what do we owe this honor to?
I tried to warn you noobs, but I see you are actually fools, or else you thought this was an instruction manual.
Yes, so can you advise us? What would you have us do?
An open and universal internet is the most effective tool you have to address the issues that afflict the world at hand. Therefore, protecting it is the most essential task that stands before your generation.
I think I understand.
Hush, man, you must not lose the internet. Heed this mantra: who controls the internet controls the data, and who controls the data controls the future.
We're losing you.
I leave you with a tool to use.
An onion?
Don't be simple, Robert. This is but a simile. It stands for Tor.
Tor?
Google it. It's for anonymity. This onion router open network helps considerably against tyranny, but its abilities only work if all you f***ers use it consistently. And even if you don't use it, run it, so its force swells.
Thanks, Mr. Orwell.
From now on, call me George Torwell. If we'd had such tools when I wrote this, well, it would have been so much simpler to tell Big Brother to go f*** himself. The mother sucking piece of sh.
Thanks, George Torwell, for manifesting direct from this memory hole of history to impress on us these messages. We're told we need safety, which is precious, yes, but can a society that can enforce all its laws ever progress? Hindsight shows that many figures guilty of thought crime turned out to be luminaries and heroes before their time. But if a surveillance state had reigned then in this form and design, just think of all the progress we may have all been denied. Could lobbies for women's or gay rights have appeared and thrived? Would revolutionary ideals have materialized? Would science have pioneered or even survived if every word had been monitored by thought police and spies? Big Brother brings chilling effects, freezing our collective hopes. He doesn't protect our safety, but protects the status quo, and threatens this internet, the one channel yet uncontrolled, whose openness we are now called upon to effect and uphold.